Dr. Cindy Geyer. She's the medical director for Canyon Ranch in Lenox, Mass. And if you haven't been there, go. She specializes in women's health issues such as transition hormones, effects of sleep deprivation and weight loss management, strategies to boost metabolism and harness energy. In addition to her role at Canyon Ranch, she is one of the core faculty members at the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. They gave me a whole page to read to you about this session, but I'm just going to let the session start because that's why you're all here. So welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm not sure if this is a positive sign or not that so many people are in a session about stress. I think that speaks to what a lot of us know on a day-in and day-out basis, that we have stress in our lives. And one of the things that I want to start with, I probably should let my other panelists introduce themselves first so you know about the expertise in the room. So if you want to do that, and then we'll talk a little bit about stress and turn it back over to them.
Hey, Sandy Stratford. I'm a physician. I'm the chief medical officer of a very dynamic company, the Raytheon Company, based in Waltham, Massachusetts. We are 63,000 people, employees globally, 59,000 in the U.S. We do everything from missiles to military training, air traffic control, sensors, cyber, homeland security. We do it all. So what do I do? Why does a company need a physician? Well, we have 24 primarily occupational health work-related clinics across the country. And originally they were put in place for regulatory issues. You know, programs put in place to make sure that the job isn't hurting you. And then as we become more global, we've developed programs for the business traveler. So travel health, and you know, we deploy people all around the globe to very challenging places. So I handle those requirements as well. And crisis management. You all know about pandemic planning and Ebola. But increasingly, I've always had to deal with people with injuries and illnesses and making sure they can return to work and perform safely. But increasingly now, I'm dealing with helping people understand their health risk so they don't develop a chronic illness. Then if they do have chronic illness, how do they manage that? So, you know, this topic of stress. So I see the impact of poor health. I see the impact of the normal family life challenges that we all have to deal with, and challenges at work. That all comes into the workplace. So now I have responsibility for those programs as well.
You're amazing.
Not really.
I'm exhausted just from here. I just got stressed.
No.
Well, my name's Loretta LaRoche, and I've taught stress management for about 35 years, so I'm not only hysterical, I'm historical. And my mechanism has always been to try to get people to lighten up and see the humor that is inherent in the human condition. And I've written 8 books. One of my favorite is Life is Short, Wear Your Party Pants. I think everyone here should have their party pants on today, or a party thong if you're interested. And I've done 7 or 8 PBS shows. And I've been very fortunate to do that which I love. And now I'm embarking on another career, but it's not really, I wouldn't say, I don't know what'll happen. But along with my stress management, I'm doing some jazz singing. And I've made an album, I just keep going. I figure by the time I'm dead, I'll have a lot of stuff that I've done. And my son manages my career, and if it's up to him, when I croak, he'll probably have a tape next to my grave that you can push a button, and it will help you with your stress.
Oh, that's great.
So she talked about crisis management. The biggest crisis management I've had is my 2 ex-husbands. So So I hope we're going to be here. We're going to have fun today, too, right?
Yeah. We're going to have some fun. So first, we want to go back to the nitty-gritty and talk about what stress really is. What is stress? I mean, it probably means different things to different one of us, to different ones of us, depending on what's going on in our lives, but we certainly know what stress feels like. And most of us understand stress in terms of that proverbial fight or flight reaction. And one of the things I want to start with is stress in and of itself is not bad. It's actually an adaptive way to deal with something that we need to face, and sometimes it's something that's threatening us. So what happens in the short term when we're stressed? Our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, our glucose, blood sugar, goes up. Our brain goes on hyper alert so we can be super focused. The blood goes away from your digestive tract and your sexual organs because they're not key for dealing with that immediate stress. And it goes to the heart and the brain and the skeletal muscles, right? So it gets us ready to either engage the threat or run away. And way back in saber-toothed tiger days, it was a short-lived stress. Because what would happen? We'd get stressed, we would either kill the tiger, we would get away from the tiger, or the tiger would eat us. And at the end of that, the end result is everything's going to reset down to baseline. So why do we talk so much about stress nowadays? Because some of us are living in fight or flight. Some researchers estimate we have as many as 50 to 100 of these fight or flight reactions every day. You know the drill. The alarm clock jolts you out of bed after 6 hours of sleep when you really needed 8, so you're rushing around, trying to get out the door, getting in rush hour traffic, getting to work, logging onto your computer, checking all the emails that should have been answered yesterday. If you bother to eat lunch at all, you're wolfing it down at your desk. Then you get back in rush hour traffic, you try to get home and figure out how you're going to get your kids to eat their fruits and vegetables, and then you have to worry about whether they're organic or not, and are you giving them the right kind of thing. Log back onto your computer and do the whole thing all over again once you collapse in bed around midnight. Now, the body doesn't know the difference between the saber-toothed tiger and the chronic sleep deprivation, rush hour traffic, stress. There's another layer to it, too. How many of you are familiar with Dr. Robert Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers? It is an oldie but goodie, and he's got a new revised version out. Now, a zebra who gets away from a tiger, 5 minutes later, they're going to be munching grass like nothing ever happened. Humans are different. We think back on that event with the tiger. The memory of the event can elicit the same stressful response. So you can see how that can become problematic. Now, if you want to know what stress does to you physiologically, probably the best analogy is to think about what happens when people have to take the prescription drug prednisone. How many have heard of prednisone? It's a steroid, right? So if you've ever had to take it or you know somebody else who takes prednisone, it's analogous to cortisol, one of the hormones we make when we're stressed. And what happens when people take prednisone? They often get hungrier, their weight goes up, their immune system is suppressed, they may notice mood changes. Those are the same things that chronic stress can lead to. We also know it's not just about not feeling so good. Stress alone accounts for 1/5 of heart attacks worldwide. So it's a huge, huge issue. That's the bad side. The positive piece about this is most of us have clues on a daily basis that our body is trying to give us that tell us when we're stressed. What are some of those? Little pit in the stomach, that tight neck muscle. Loretta and I were talking right before the conversation, right before the session, how I had the urge to go to the bathroom. That's a pretty common stress response. But what do? We're all busy. So those little clues that our body gives us, we're much more quick to grab the over-the-counter antacid, the ibuprofen, because we don't have time to pay attention to those clues. We want to plow through and move on. We need to learn to pay attention, and those clues are often what we can use to shift gears and learn to embrace some of the strategies that we're going to hear from our wonderful panel of experts about how we can shift the response, learn some tools, and mitigate the impact that stress can have on us. So with that, I'm going to ask a few questions of our panelists. So Dr. Stratford, what are some of the ways that you see stress showing up for women in the workplace, or men?
Good question. What do I see? Well, first of all, I'll talk about the concept. You've all heard the concept of emotional intelligence. So sort of being attuned to what others are feeling, the way they're reacting to you. Well, what I see is that often people don't have a much understanding of what's going on internally within themselves. And, you know, that's what I have to deal with. So, you know, there's some obvious things, you know, I see people coming down, oh, I have palpitations. Usually this is around performance review time. I have palpitations, my blood pressure's up. I have people coming down, both men and women, who are teary. I don't feel well. I don't know why. I'll get into the concept of resiliency, but the resilient person, one of the characteristics is they understand these triggers and they have some sort of daily rhythm and know how to get back to a normal state and control it. But I see a lot of people who wait till they get to that tipping point. Some stress is good. I like a good deadline. I think it's very inspirational at times and gets me going. But, you know, you put the deadline on top of maybe what's going on at home, etc. You need to know when to turn it off, when to shake off some things and move on. But, you know, what I also see, we have various wellness programs like health assessments, on-site metabolic screenings, employee assistance programs. So what am I seeing? Well, you know, people who take the health assessment, we have 82% of people taking the health assessment saying they don't exercise enough. We have, if you look at our on-site biometric screening, we have 30% who have numbers saying they're overweight, another 40% saying they're obese. And then you look at our employee assistance program utilization. You know, last year, it's public knowledge, but Raytheon went through a huge reorganization going from six businesses to four. Well, prior to that reorganization, our employee assistance program utilization, so this is programs, a confidential outlet where you can have one-on-one discussions about any stressor, any issue, family, work, whatever you need to work through in your life. Well, you know, we were averaging prior to that maybe 5% utilization a year. After that, it went to 8% utilization a year. So this is what I see as a manifestation of that. And the problem with stress is when we're not resilient and when we can't sort of not only rebound but come back better, reset, rev up, come back to normal. The problem with stress is it's counter to everything that's healthy. So you want to exercise less, you want to eat more, you sleep less than six hours. I think 30% of our people surveyed said they get under 6 hours a night of sleep. You put all that together, it just builds. And the concept of resiliency, of recovering, getting back to normal, taking a break, you know, that's what we need to do.
Great. And along those lines of how we recover and get back to normal, Loretta, how did you decide that humor was a coping mechanism that was one of the effective ingredients to help people deal with their stress?
Well, I come from a funny Italian family, so it's kind of a genetic predisposition for me, and also the way I was enculturated. They were extremely dysfunctional, but very funny. And when I first got into this, I was actually doing some corporate work in communications because that's one of my degrees. But then I met a nurse who started talking to me about how Norman Cousins had survived something called ankylosing spondylitis, which is an arthritic condition which is very painful, by using humorous videos and having people tell him jokes, and his sed rate went down and his pain was altered time after time by watching funny movies. So I thought, wow, this is right up my alley. I'm going to create a program called Laughter and Healing. But I didn't know what the heck I was even doing. So I just started putting pieces of it together and trying to get people to laugh at me, at what I was saying. But then after, as time went by, I started reading some of the books by Albert Ellis, Dr. Albert Ellis, who created rational emotive therapy, and Dr. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, both of whom used some humor to treat their patients. Dr. Ellis has come up with all kinds of things like, you know, don't shoot on yourself. Do any of you shoot on yourself? Then when you're done, you shoot on other people. And Dr. Frankl came up with something called paradoxical intention. So I had this epiphany. What I really have to try to do is get people to laugh at themselves. You see, we're all a joke for the most part. It's hard to really realize that and not to take offense at that statement. But if you start to think about what you think about, you will crack up from morning till night. So my intention is to get people, first of all, to become aware. You know, you talk about paying attention. How can you pay attention if you're not really awake? See, a lot of us are in a daze. We're so dazed by our what we have to do. I mean, think about how much time do you spend telling people how much you have to do? I got so much to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I have so much to do. And you know what? Nobody cares. Nobody cares how much you have to do. Because there, it becomes a contest. They have to tell you how, what they're doing. And now we phone fondle all day. We fondle phones. If you're not listening to me, I'm going to call somebody and tell them. And you see, all that can be funny if you wake up. The poet Rumi, the ancient Persian poet, said, wake up, wake up. You've been asleep 1,000 years. We are not a culture that is awake. We have to wake up to what we're doing all day long. We don't have to be doing all day long. And once you get that point, you wake up, you can start to initiate an internal sense of humor about yourself. You know, start to see how funny you are. Embrace your humanity. We're all pretty funny characters, aren't we? And we don't have to laugh at anybody. We can laugh at ourselves. And if you bring that to your company, if you're fun and you can laugh at yourself, people will embrace you instead of erase you. They will move towards you and say, why? I want to be with them. They've got a joyful countenance, and they understand their human foibles.
Thank you. I like what you said about the shoulds, because I think that also comes up a lot for physicians when we're talking to people about being healthy. And it's a little bit of a dance. You know, we want people to eat foods that are going to nourish them and move their bodies in a way that can be an outlet for stress, but we get that should in there. Well, I should have eaten the vegetables, but I ate the cupcake. I should have been exercising, and instead I sat. That doesn't help from a stress standpoint. So I think the other piece is to do the best you can in the moment, and you're going to have a chance to make another choice at the next time you sit down to eat. Okay, so Dr. Stratford, do you prefer Dr. Stratford?
Call me Sandy.
Sandy. Are there questions that you found helpful as tools for people to try to gauge where they are on that stress scale and to recognize and pay attention when they're exhibiting signs of stress?
Yes, and I just happened to bring some of those with me. But we had an opportunity, my corporate employee assistance program director and myself had the opportunity to... opportunity to put together a program. Actually, we were requested by our human resources organization to put together some learning on resilience. So what is that resilient person? And I have to say I had to kind of think about this. You know, I view myself personally as a very resilient person. I think I know when to take a break. I like to take vacations, nice vacations occasionally. I like to hit a golf ball, let out some frustration. But, you know, a few questions. So we thought of a very basic questionnaire that focused on physical energy, sleep, overall health, how connected you were with other people, and what are your stressors? And just basic questions. I have enough energy to get what I have to do done. I'm too tired to do it. I don't have energy to do what I need to accomplish. Sleep. I sleep 6 to 8 hours. I don't sleep 6 to 8 hours. I feel joyful. I feel blah all the time. You rate those low risk, intermediate risk, high risk, and we were able to give people a score. And we didn't want to know what the score was, but we just wanted people to sit, take 10 minutes in a room, think inwardly, and answer these questions and give themselves a score. And at the and then we went through training in terms of sort of what are the attributes or qualities of a resilient person. So we went through all the medical issues, the physiology behind it that Dr. Geyer talked about. But you know, but what is a resilient person? What do they do? So first we asked the question, well, everyone, what's a resilient company? What do they do? Well, they use what they have. They use what they have externally. They use the resources internally. They're creative, innovative. They plan. They always have you have a plan A, plan B, plan C. You have a plan for the unexpected. You pull it all together and you need a challenge or a solution, and often not only does the company survive the challenge, but they come back even better ultimately than they were before. And it is challenging. So you look at the person. So what's a resilient person? The same thing. You know, really the same thing. You know, you have to commit to getting a job done. You have to commit to your family. You have to commit to your inner needs and your health. You know, and these, you know, recognize these triggers for stress. You know, you have to commit to maybe a purpose or a mission. I find that, you know, resilient people also give back to get. You know, I personally, you know, I like non-for-profit. I'm involved in a lot of non-for-profit organizations. You know, it's sort of healing the mind, you're healing the body and the soul as well as the mind, keeping all that together. And challenges, you know, look at challenges and opportunities. You've heard it before, glass as, you know, half full, as opposed to half empty, the humor that Loretta talks about. You know, all that's, you know, very, very important. And then realizing what we can control, what we can't, and sort of shaking off the baggage or the unnecessary. You know, I personally, you know, back in 97, 98, I had a challenging time. You know, I lost both of my parents within like 8 months of each other. I had moved for a new job. I got promoted during that time in the job. I got married, engaged and married, and I think by the end of 1998, I also sold my parents' home. So I had sort of watched all these life events play out. And you know, when people ask me, well, what sort of held you together, work helped me focus, but it was being connected to people that I loved. I think I was very conscious of my health. And more importantly, I think, you know, I was younger, living in New York at the time and living this kind of, I guess, what I called a jazzy lifestyle, and caught up in some of the hype. And I think once all that played out, there's certain things that you realize you don't need to be bothered with anymore. There's certain things that are really important and core to what you need to be successful, and you shake off everything else. And I think that's a big key to resilience.
Thank you. So, Loretta, back to you. is laughter and fun really good medicine?
Well, I know for a fact that when people are clinically depressed, they don't laugh at all. And so as you begin to lose your laughter potential, you are really spiraling more and more into a dark place. So it's really valuable to sort of consider that, to see if you're enjoying life, if you're laughing. You know, they've done studies, don't ask me how they do this, but they've noticed that four-year-olds laugh something like 400 times a day. I don't know, they drug them, put them behind walls. And we spend money on these things, too. Adults, they say, laugh 15 times a day. And there is some statistics on the fact that the misery index is climbing, particularly in America, because we're workaholics. We wait to have fun and laugh, right? We're waiting for Friday. Friday, we'll have fun. Not today. I'm going to a conference. I have to be very serious. I have to learn as much as I can, for God's sake. I paid for this, didn't I? So, I'm going to do a little test with you. Right now, some of you are sitting here like dead parrots, right? You came in early, you put the kids, whatever you had to do, and so you... Now, one of the things that laughter does is it relaxes the body. It's a catharsis. That's why they now have comedy channels in hospitals. They use them in pain clinics. I mean, I worked at Harvard with Herb Benson for 15 years and developed the humor and optimism program. And I know for a fact that laughter helps people. Now, it's not easy to laugh sometimes when you're going through hard times. And we know that for certain. But you can laugh without having anything funny to laugh at. And it still works because you still get the chemical response. Dr. Madan Kattari came here from India and started the worldwide laughing tour. You've heard of laughter yoga, where people get together and just go, ha, 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 ha. And you could actually start a staff laugh in your company and get groups of people to laugh for just 5 minutes. And I tell you, those meetings you have will go faster and be more fun. So I want you to do a little CAT scan on your body right now. I want you to scan. Just feel where the tension is. Is it in your neck, in your shoulders, in your lower back, in your abdomen, wherever it is? And I want to do this. May I do an exercise with that? And I want to do an exercise that I do with audience. I've done this with the IRS. I've done this with four-star generals at the Pentagon. I've done it in the Senate. So we're going to do it here. And some of you may be put off a little. I'm the head of HR department. I'm very important, but yeah. But you're still going to die, okay? So I want you to engage in this just from the childlike point of view, which is the beginner's mind, as John Kabat-Zinn calls it. Everything is always new again, if you believe it is. Okay? So everybody, just smile. It's hard to be pissed off when you smile. Try it in traffic sometimes. Just look in your rearview mirror. See, because your brain gets confused. All right, now we're going to just go through a laugh. It's only going to take like a minute. So everybody now, open your eyes wide like you're in alert status. Because when you laugh, that's what's happening. You want, oh, wow. Now, raise your eyebrows so you look tall and thin. This is my new diet. Laugh your butt off. Now, everybody, reach down and grab hold of your belly, whatever you find, you know? Don't make excuses. I don't know where it came from. I always tell everybody, you fed it, it's yours. Now, if you don't have any, you can't find it, hang on to somebody next to you. And you may be next to one of those spinners, you know, they're spinning, they're walking, they're jogging, they're jumping. But they're going to die too. So, hang on to whatever you found or theirs. And I want you to look at somebody now while you're hanging on to a piece of flesh. Because when we laugh together, we become soulmates. So, are you ready now? Grab a hold of it. I want you to feel a belly laugh. So on the count of three, we're going to guffaw for 30 seconds. Okay, now there might be some people who want to continue to suffer. So, are we ready? Okay, 30 seconds, guffaw, real. Seriously, can feel a certain degree of letting go. And you know what, folks? It's free. It's free. We want to find out why doctors aren't asking us how often are you laughing. Because your blood pressure goes down when you laugh. It opens up your capillary function. You're not squeezing as much.
So, Loretta, you really have earned the title you shared with me before the event of Mirth Doctor.
Yes.
I love it.
MD, Mirth Doctor.
And I'm going to invite you to do some wellness programs.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
You know, one other thing that I like was what you said about four-year-olds and how often they laugh. How many of you spend time around young kids or pets? Mm-hmm. Aren't they another great way to tap into joy? Because they're very present in the moment. They haven't embraced the shoulds yet, so that's another good way to access it. So, Sandy, let's come back to you. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the concept of resilience and the attributes of a resilient person? Because you started to talk about balancing, you know, the challenge of being up and having a deadline with the recovery period.
You know, I view it not as balance. I view it as a lot of prioritization. Because you only have 24 hours in a day, it's not a balance. It's what's taking priority at one time or another. And, you know, the physiological issues, the cortisol, the epinephrine, you rev up. But you can't keep on doing that. So you can't keep on revving up. You meet one deadline and then you stay at that same level. And those epinephrine and those cortisol levels are the same, and you bump up to the next deadline and the next issue, and then it's the family issue on top of it. You have to come back down to normal, and that's where whether it's laughter, whether it's exercise, whatever you need to do to come back to normal. So to me, it's stress plus recovery back to normal equals resiliency. The other reason, I looking at it from a personal issue, when you miss a life milestone of a child or a loved one, you know, because of work, you can't get that back. So it's not a balance. It's you making that decision to make something a priority at that time, and maybe at another time maybe that report you had to write isn't quite as good as it usually is because the night before you did have to go to your child's baseball game and do a birthday party or something like that. So to me, it's not a balance. It's what's that most important thing that you have to get done at that time. I think resilient people are very good at doing that. I think people think that resilient people do a lot of multitasking. Well, we know from the studies now, multitasking is detrimental to your health. You know, it gives you a false sense that you're doing really well. But you know, the scientific testing has shown that what you do over time is you start to make more mistakes and you start to mess up. Also, again, there's that chronic increased cortisol while you're doing that. You know, that isn't good as well. And they're even showing that there's changes, you know, in the brain on the MRI, you know, while you're multitasking.
Great. I like that idea of priorities, that each time you're making a choice and making a priority. And when Loretta mentioned Jon Kabat-Zinn, another concept that he's really brought out in the forefront is the concept of mindfulness, being present in the moment without judgment. And I think that's another aspect we can bring to bear when we make that choice. If we choose to go to our child's baseball game, we want to be present at that baseball game, not thinking about the report that's waiting for us the next day. So it's another layer of making the choice and then being present with that choice and accepting of it before we make the next choice. Okay, last question, and then we're going to open it up to some questions from the audience. So, Loretta, that guffaw exercise was excellent. I think all of us felt our stress levels go down if we had any when we came in the room. I certainly did. Wow. Are there some other tools and techniques that you offer individuals to help them lighten up?
Well, I did want to make a point about the fact that we really have to embrace the fact that we're all individually, biologically different. You know, not everybody is able to embrace all of the things that we're talking about because sometimes your biology gets in the way. Some of us are more overreactive in the way we deal with life. You jump to conclusions or you catastrophize and awfulize over everything. And you have to pay attention to that. So to find out who and what you're really about. And then start to think about, I talk about the committee. Everybody in this room has a committee you live with. People from your childhood, people you met along the way, they're in your head. Sometimes they're like a bunch of monkeys who want a banana. And you may be trying to assuage someone from your past and their rules and regulations, rather than becoming your most authentic self and doing those things which you're attuned to and want to live by. I grew up with a mother from the Depression era, and she was always concerned that you were going to do something and be too frivolous and buy something you didn't need, and had to save everything because you never know. You never know. I don't know what you don't know, but you just don't know. And I was the only child, and I had to be a perfectionist, and she had rules about everything. You leave the house, you make the bed first, because you never know. Are any of you like that? How many of you like that? You never know. And I used to seriously almost get panic-stricken when I left the house if the bed was unmade. I think, what if somebody finds out? And a lot of us have those thoughts, don't we? What if somebody finds out I didn't do those things I was told I should do? And then I realized there's no bed checkers. No one comes. No one checks the beds. Don't leave any dishes in the sink. I could not go to bed without cleaning the sink out. Can't leave those dishes there. Now I realize, who cares? Put them in your car. Take them to work. You know, prioritize. How important is it? Is somebody going to find out that you left them there? Yeah, they'll accumulate, but you know, you're not going to be found in the midst of a bunch of dishes someday, dead. They'll get done, right? Oh, how many of you are cleaning crazos? You know, like you don't let any... Don't go in that room. I just cleaned it. That's the way, you know, I grew up like that too. I used to clean the oven dials with a Q-tip. Don't go in that room. Somebody might come. You know, I bring this stuff up because some of us do this. Good towels, we have good towels. And you see, the techniques I share with people is to recognize those irrational statements, because we have 60,000 thoughts a day. Many of them are very disturbing. Aren't they? And women ruminate. We're like a dog with a bone. We go over stuff. And you know, you sort of terrorize your family. Don't sit on that sofa, it's new. Those are the good towels. And you should laugh at those statements because they're nuts. Tell them, here, take a rag, wipe yourself with that. Because you're not good enough to have these towels. See, try becoming a bit of Seinfeld. Have somebody tape you. You know, listen to yourself. Listen to yourself at work, because you take yourself at work and you do the same thing. That's my good pencil. Don't use that. Do any of you see yourself as comedic? So that's what Viktor Frankl would do with people. He called it paradoxical intention. Take that which disturbs you and disturb yourself to the point where it becomes hysterical. Walk around your house. Don't leave any towels on the bed. The towel Nazi's coming today. He's going to be checking on you to see, and if you do it, you will be jailed for a number of years. You know, if you're in traffic, see, I'm never getting out of here. They're going to find me dead tomorrow in my car. Because you are doing that anyway. Do you understand? And just a couple of other things. I would practice the inner smile. Think about your smile coming from the inside out. Make yourself realize that smiling can encompass your entirety. It doesn't have to be just an outward look. It's an inward look, because that's where a smile comes from. It comes from the inside out. And, you know, I practice the heart math method, where I put my hand on my heart and I think of someone that I love and who loved me, like my grandmother Francesca, who would make me a meatball in a second. And I just breathe in love and breathe out stress. And it makes me smile. So you might want to look up the heart math method on the internet. Dr. Childress in Stockton, California. He's one of the gurus of mindfulness as well.
Great. Two more quick questions before we open up the mics. And if you could each just give me one brief way that you, one of the key things in your own personal life for how you maintain your resilience and manage stress. And I'm going to start by saying mine. I learned years ago, after working in an emergency room and being the mother of twin boys, that sleep had to be a priority. Mm-hmm. And all the other stuff fell by the wayside if I didn't get enough sleep, because if you think about it, that's where we do our recovery time. And when I talk to people, that's often, you can't do everything at once. I'll often focus first there, make sure you're dedicating enough time to get good sleep, and you create a space where you can get good quality sleep. So that's one of my priorities. And if you could share a couple of yours, that would be helpful.
My work with nonprofits is, and it's ongoing, but I enjoy it. It takes my mind off of what I'm doing at work, although I can bring my skill set from work off, you know, to some of what I'm doing. But I really find that sort of giving of myself nourishes me in another way, and I think that that's very important.
Loretta?
I try to practice being the fun instead of trying to have fun. And that's what I promote. Become the fun you're seeking. Don't seek the fun. And I try to have fun wherever I go. I mean, I'm not always in the mood. But more often than not, I become in the mood because I'm having fun. And I also believe in reinvention. I try to say to myself, what's next? What can I do to increase hopefulness and the realization that I'm still alive and that I couldn't keep going. So I started singing jazz, because I'm now married to a jazz guy. And I made an album. I think everybody here should be considering, what do you want to do next? Instead of just living in quiet desperation.
I would like to offer the opportunity for anybody who has a burning question they want to ask one of our panelists to come up to the mic, because we've got, I think you've gotten a lot of good tips and a little laughter, a lot of laughter, and now there are some specific questions.
Hi, my name is...
Are the mics...
My name is Laurie, and it's not a question, it's a comment to Loretta.
Hope it's not bad. I'll have to kill myself.
Do we have anybody? It's on? Do you want to lean close?
It's on. So, my name is Laurie, and for Loretta, I grew up in a household where you had to make your bed before you left. And I did that for years and years and years. And like you said, no one came and checked my bed, except I was married at the time, and I got a call from work. My mother-in-law, with her friend, showed up in my house, and she showed them my new house, and it was the only day I did not...
I love it, don't you?
Thank you for sharing.
Hi, Sandy.
Hello,
hi. So I like to see how many people here who feel like they have a sleep problem. Right. And I'm right there with them. What is the secret to getting a full night's sleep? I mean, I've tried it all. Turning off the things, taking baths, you know, not drinking caffeine, drugs, everything. And it's like the holy grail. Like 6 solid hours of sleep would be magnificent, never mind 8. So any ideas on other than, you know, lavender pillows and things like that?
We have a program at work.
And luckily I work at Raytheon, so I can take advantage of that program.
Actually, on if you've tried watching your caffeine, the quiet room at night, not working on your email right up until you go to bed, turning off the bright lights, not having a TV in your bedroom. How many people have TVs in their bedroom? Okay, I don't.
That's how I fall asleep.
All right, not having TV in your bedroom. If you've tried listening to quiet music, that doesn't work. If you've tried maybe some mild exercise before bedtime, not heavy exercise, but a little light exercise, sometimes that helps too. If you've tried all of that and you can't sleep, we have people who can help you. I think probably more discussion. There are sleep specialists that get into actually timing when you go to bed versus when you wake up. You probably travel a lot. That throws everything off. But there's actually an app, and I forget the name, but I'm sure you can search it. There's an app that you can put on your phone that, depending on where you're traveling to, will tell you when and how much you should adjust your waking up and going to bedtime prior to the travel, so that you're set when you get there and what you should do on the other end prior to going back. But I think when you look at the big picture, there are people, we actually have a program on our website, Sleep Specialist, that will get into really much more detailed questions about sleep, what's going on. medications, health issues, that all can play into it.
I have a couple just additional things to add to that. So one of the paradoxes is that we all want to get better sleep, and we shoot ourselves in the foot when we start to get anxious and worried about the fact that we're in bed not sleeping and all the things that are going to happen as a result. Sometimes shifting the focus a little bit and allowing yourself to relax, and the sleep comes. You take the focus away from actively trying to fall asleep. And to dovetail with what you said about the TV, if somebody's really having a hard time falling asleep, keep in mind that the lights from your electronic devices will completely wipe out melatonin, which is what helps you set your internal clock. So I would actually encourage people to have no lighted devices or screens for 2 hours before they try to fall asleep. I know it's a challenge, but I think, and keep in mind, this is geared for the person who's having a hard time falling asleep. So it's a challenge, but it's one that I think is really important to pay attention to.
Puts me to sleep.
Yes, you have a question.
I'm looking for solutions for exercise and integrating that into a busy life. Working mom, lots to do 24 hours by 7. What, in the spirit of prioritization, if you were going to suggest just some small changes that I could make or we could make to integrate exercise, what would you suggest?
Okay, I'll be honest. I'm not good at it either, but one, you have to look at what's your day look like realistically. You hear the 150 minutes a week, so that's 30 minutes 5 days a week. The reality is some of us can only get 10 to 15 minutes brisk walking at a time. Maybe that's at lunch, maybe that's first thing in the morning, maybe that's after work. You don't have to do it all at the same time, but a little bit together. It's the amount of steps as well, the various Fitbits, Garmin, etc., to track. 3,000 steps, that's roughly a half an hour, decreases cardiac risk over time, increases life expectancy. It's every little bit helps. But the key thing about exercise is why to do it. It's because you live longer. So that should be enough motivation. That 30 minutes a day, however you get it, increases your life expectancy like 3 to 4 years over time, regardless of whether you're overweight, male, female, etc. So that should be a reason to make it a priority.
I think if we keep worrying about all this, we're going to die sooner. That's what I think.
And again, that's the balance. I think finding ways to work it into your day. If you're somebody who has to be in a meeting, stand up for your meeting instead of sitting for your meeting. If you use an electric toothbrush that goes for 2 minutes, do your squats while you're brushing your teeth. I mean, you're just standing there anyway. Get in the habit of, it sounds silly, but it really works. You take the stairs instead of the elevator.
I never talk on the remote without walking.
Exactly. If you do conference calls, you get up in pace.
Walk. You can integrate it into just daily activity.
They've even come up with under the desk ellipticals that if you have to sit, you can pedal.
Right.
So they're ways, and it's really less about dedicating the half hour to exercise than it is finding ways to incorporate movement all day long.
Some of this is so funny, isn't it?
Yes.
Whenever I get stressed, like up in my head, it always, manifests itself physically. So my body gets tense and clenches, and I have trouble unclenching and staying unclenched. It's hard to relax, and then it's hard to stay relaxed. So, any tips for how to hold on to that relaxed feeling when it does come?
I'd put some music on and dance if I were you. I'm serious. Get some earbuds or wherever you are, just take a 2 minute break dancing. You've got to interrupt the stress cycle, and you have to figure out ways to do it. I tell people to twirl. If you twirl around a few minutes and you say what's bothering you out loud, it's almost impossible to be stressed because it becomes funny. Go look in the mirror and make some funny faces at yourself. I mean, think of what a kid does to stay in sort of a joyful countenance. They're always shaking themselves out, looking at people. I'm doing. We get so adult, we get so worried. Oh my God! Oh my God!
I'm stressed! In fact, you could even imitate yourself. Go up to somebody you work with and say, look what's happening. I don't know. That's my take on it because I'm a silly woman.
I actually think you've already done the first most important thing. You're aware.
Yeah, exactly.
And once you have that awareness, when you pay attention to it and use it to shift gears and say, okay, my body is clearly telling me that I'm stressed. What do I need to do at this moment in time, whether that's call a friend, dance and twirl. But the awareness, you're ahead of the game.
You're not kidding.
And breathing, just taking a moment to do quiet breathing. That works for a minute. Some deep breaths. And you've probably sat through the sessions where people say sit still and sort of focus, get everything else out of your mind and focus on relaxing every single part of your body. It only takes 5 minutes. You know, you're not going to miss a meeting, you're not going to miss a deadline trying to do this. But, you know, sometimes things can get, you know, you get so annoyed or, you know, you're just on edge and you need to stop because, you know, one thing, people can sense that in you too. You know, so you have to think of how you're showing up in the workplace when you're like this, and it's not probably what you want. You want to appear exactly the opposite of that. So whatever you need to do, whether it's get up and walk out and take a deep breath in the bathroom or walk around the site, you know, I see people walking around our headquarters, you know, they're doing those laps, you know, all of that helps. And then you're refreshed and, you know, you're together.
So. One other piece to bring in as well is that if it keeps coming back, it may be that you need to look at the environment that's contributing to it in the first place. And that's sometimes hard to do, but that was a lesson I learned when I was in the emergency room. I had repeated stress symptoms, and fortunately I was able to pay attention and say, it's the job. I needed to make a change. So I don't mean to make that personal, but that's something to pay attention to.
Thank you.
Thank you. One last question. Oh, I think Loretta has to go to a book signing, so I want to, so follow her down and buy one of her books and get it signed.